You're listening to the podcast version of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Write the Book airs every Monday at 2 on the Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. The show features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Vermont author Doug Wilhelm, whose latest book for young adults, The Prince of Denial, was published this month by Longstride Books. Doug Wilhelm is the author of 14 books, several of which were written as part of the Choose Your Own Adventure series. His young adult novel, The Revealers, a realistic story that deals with bullying in middle school, has been used as the focus of reading and discussion projects by over 200 schools across the U.S., and as far away as Pakistan and Bangladesh. Many of these projects have been school and community-wide reads aimed at stimulating awareness and positive action on bullying. The book's website is the-revealers.com. Doug often visits schools and communities that are discussing The Revealers, along with his 11th novel, Falling, which deals with drug addiction. He is a former Vermont reporter for the Boston Globe and a full-time professional writer. He received the 2008 Kids Count Award from the nonprofit Voices for Vermont's Children for making a difference in the lives of young people in his home state. He and his family live in Weybridge, Vermont. I spoke to Doug Wilhelm in 2009.
So you've written 12 books, is that right?
12 that have been published.
You know,
most every writer can tell you about their books that never got published.
But that are in the drawer.
That are in the drawer, yeah. But those are the ones that I managed to get.
Now, how many did you write before you published one?
Yes, that's a good question. I have counted that in the past. I think there were a total of 4 books that I had completed and tried to publish, and there were a couple of other projects that were maybe a first draft, but, you know, didn't go anywhere. But there were 4 books that garnered altogether over 115 rejections.
Oh.
My first book, which was a nonfiction book for adults based on traveling in the Muslim world in the aftermath of the Iranian hostage crisis way back in the early 80s, I left my newspaper job to travel with a portable typewriter, and I wrote everything down, and I just tried to talk to people and find out who these people were and why they seemed to be so mad at us, you know. In retrospect, I was kind of maybe ahead of the time a little bit, but I was also ahead of the publishing world, and it was, that book was rejected about 75 times.
Oh.
Nobody would ever publish it.
By agents or publishers?
I went through 2 agents. One was a smaller agent in Cambridge, Mass., and one was a kind of a big-time agent in Manhattan. Neither one of them could sell it, and I also, for several years before I got either of those agents, tried to sell it. Mm-hmm. It came close a number of times, and I think the reason that book didn't make it was probably a mix. I was too young to try such a large concept book. It was a nonfiction book I was trying to write as sort of a novel of discovery, you know, and it was both personal and also kind of worldly, I guess, you know. It was a great concept, but it was my first book, and it was maybe more than I should have tried to pull off without more experience. And also, it was judged non-commercial. You know, this was the 90s, before 9/11, and editors said, we don't think that people want to read about the Muslim world. We don't think that this kind of story is going to have an audience. So I learned a lot. And I don't think I would have been the same writer had I not done that book. And a lot of writers will tell you about their first book that nobody would print.
Right.
But that was mine.
So then your first published book was a young reader's novel, or...?
Yes, I got asked to write for a series, which was called Choose Your Own Adventure.
Oh!
R.A. Montgomery.
Montgomery.
Right, Ray Montgomery.
Ray and Shannon.
Exactly.
Yes.
I knew Shannon first. Shannon... Gilligan, Ray's wife, is also a writer. And we just knew each other because I was living in Montpelier at the time and we had mutual friends, and she's very nice, and so we were friendly. And, you know, it's sort of the depth of where I'd had all these books rejected. I was headed to a Little League baseball game on a Saturday morning on my bicycle in Montpelier. I had a girlfriend at the time whose son was playing Little League. And so Shannon was at a light at the corner of State and Main, the corner in Montpelier, and so we were chatting, and she said, well, what are you doing these days? And I said, well, you know, I write for a living. I do a lot of projects, And that was all I was doing. I was pretty discouraged about books at that point. And I said, well, I'll just work. And then she said, well, Ray needs some help. You know, do you have time to write one of these Choose Your Own Adventure books? And she said, we'll pay you. And of course, to a freelance writer, those are the magic words, we'll pay you. And so I had about 2 weeks, believe it or not, to write, it was at Christmas time, to write a science fiction novel for young adults in the Choose Your Own Adventure format, which was a unique interactive format. It looked like a regular book, but it didn't read like one. You had to get choices throughout the book so that the story hopped around all these different paths. I'd never read science fiction. I'm not a sci-fi person, but they offered me, you know, they offered me money for it, and it sounded interesting. I'd never written fiction. I was a nonfiction. I was a journalist, and but I did it. It was Christmas time, and it sounded like a lot more fun than writing yet another newsletter annual report for a hospital or whatever I was doing. So I did a book called The Forgotten Planet. They had about a one-sentence idea they'd sold to the publisher, which was, a planet gets forgotten. Write the book. That was it. That was all Ray remembered, that he'd sold to the publisher the idea, a planet gets forgotten, and he didn't have time to write it. So I wrote it. And that was the first published book. It was called The Forgotten Planet. And I wound up doing 8 books for that series over the next 4 years. And what I found was that I really liked writing fiction for young adults. I'd never thought of myself as being imaginative and enough that I could write fiction, but these stories were fun.
Did you get a byline on those books?
Yep, I got a byline.
Those books aren't published under their names?
No, they've both written a number of them, but they also subcontracted to a number of writers.
Okay.
There were over 80 books in this series, and I wrote 8 of them, and Ray wrote a number, and Shannon wrote some. Ray's son wrote 1 or 2 at least, and I knew other people who'd written a couple of them up in your area. I kind of connected with it, and I wound up doing 2 per year for about 4 years. So I worked with, the publisher was Bantam Doubleday Dell, and I worked with several editors. And it was really like basic training in YA fiction, because you had to write a really good page turner of a story. And after 8 books, I felt I wanted to move on, and then I went on and started writing regular young adult novels. And the first of those, and I've written 3 of those that have been published, and then I have my first young adult nonfiction book coming out.
So the 3 were Raising the Shades, Falling, and The Revealers?
Right. Raising the Shades came out in 2001, so that was my first book after that series. Then The Revealers came out in 2003. That's the one that has kind of, you know, built an audience since then. And then Falling, my most recent novel, came out in 2007.
Okay.
And then I have this new one coming out in 2009.
Right. And the new one is Alexander the Great. This book is a departure for you from what you've become known for. So what inspired you to do this book?
Well, this was another, it was similar in a way to how I got involved with the series Choose Your Own Adventure. This is written for a series that's published by Scholastic called Wicked Histories. And I have a friend in Montpelier, Todd Olson, who is a very talented editor and writer, and Todd is the editor for this series. And Todd and I were talking, and he said, would you like to do one of these books? And I've always liked history. I've always read history as a young adult. I read a lot of, you know, YA nonfiction, the famous old Landmark series that was so great when I was growing up. They would hire good writers to write nonfiction books about history, historical biographies, and I loved those. And in recent years, I had had a small interest in Alexander the Great. I'd read a book, one of his biographies, and watched the movie that Oliver Stone had done. So when Todd said, we need somebody to write an Alexander biography, I said, great, I can do that. And so it was a fun project. This is part of a series, and so it has a certain formula. It's written in a very novelistic kind of storytelling fashion. It's heavily illustrated.
Very readable.
Very readable. A small window for text. This is not a lot of words, and that was very challenging because Alexander's story is incredibly rich.
Yeah.
Incredibly important, really. He probably had more effect on the world than any individual, you know, outside of religious leaders, you could argue, in history. And I had to tell this story and all these battles and all these betrayals and all this stuff, this intrigue and the meaning of it all within a very small number of words.
Right, I'm trying to think here. It's like a 5x6 format, and you've got probably 120 pages of actual. Yeah. Well, it's probably not even that much prose because you've got some diagrams.
A lot of
in
diagrams and illustrations. I think if I remember right, that it was about 5,000 words was the limit, which is the length of one of those in-depth New Yorker articles. You know.
Right.
So for a book that tells this guy's story, and it was such a huge story and such an incredibly interesting guy, and he had such an impact not only on his time but on history. To put that all in 5,000 words. It's always harder to write short. Any writer will tell you that.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge. For example, to put in Alexander in the context of the Greek world and its importance to the evolution of civilization, I had one page. I'm looking at it now. Five short, relatively short paragraphs under the title Athens, Cradle of Civilization. Now try to do justice to that in five paragraphs. But you're writing, this is a well-designed series for young adults to sort of immerse them into great stories of the past. The idea of the series, which I think is terrific, is really major figures who had really major dark sides in history. So Alexander the Great, very brave, very dashing, very heroic, but also very murderous, very, very dark. And some of the other people in the series have been like Attila the Hun, and I think Hitler is one of the 20th century projects, and so they have that. That's the idea of the wicked histories.
Right.
And that
right.
was fun to do.
You know? The opening epigraph of your book, Alexander the Great, Master of the Ancient World, is by Ephippus of Olynthus, is that correct? Is that how I'm saying it? Stillness and silence born of fear held fast all who were in his presence, for he was intolerable and murderous, reputed in fact to be melancholy, mad. And then later in the book, you talk about the fact that they have sort of retrospectively diagnosed him possibly with bipolar disorder.
Yeah, and alcoholism
And alcoholism.
Well. Yeah.
And I found that really interesting. I mean, he accomplished so much by the age of 33. He must have done it all in his manic states.
Yeah.
And did he have periods of time where he wouldn't do anything?
Oh, yeah. Especially, this guy was on the road, on the campaign trail for, I think, 9 years. They left home and set off to conquer the Persian Empire, and which was most of the known world, and they succeeded, and they went beyond and got as far as Western India. So there's a huge amount of territory that they conquered, and number of battles they fought. It's incredible battles all over the known old world, from Greece, northern Greece, where Alexander started fighting, all the way to across the Indus River in India. Incredible stories, and they were out there fighting for 9 years. So that was a hard life, and drinking wine and sort of partying was part of that Greek aristocratic culture that Alexander, who was technically Macedonian, north of Greece, but he grew up in that sort of ancient Greece culture that Macedonia was kind of a neighbor of and part of. And so they were drinkers and partiers all the way through, but I think as this grueling campaign wore on, the record shows that their parties got darker and harsher, and Alexander's moods, his dark moods, got deeper and blacker and often more murderous. And I'm no psychologist, obviously, but he clearly, if there's a bipolar guy in history, he's clearly him.
Right.
You know, he would have these manic phases where he would just be incredibly brave and incredibly adventurous and incredibly daring, and then he would have these black depressions where he would drink for, you know, literally 36 hours, and sometimes this would end up with, you know, murdering one of his best friends or ordering a whole town to be slaughtered, or, you know, these horribly dark outcomes. So yeah, he was not a guy you wanted to get on the bad side.
Just don't even want to get to know him.
His dark side was very dark, and at the same time, he was incredibly visionary. And he had a lot of bright side. He had a lot of ideals, and he wanted to create a different kind of world where there was interchange and openness between different cultures. And he did, in fact, create that. He opened up the whole ancient world. He destroyed this very, very old, very conservative Persian Empire that had ruled most of the known world, and he opened up this whole new world of interchange and openness. The Greek culture was very open to different ideas and different religions and different languages and different races. He was the first person in history to open up a society to that kind of attitude beyond Greece's homeland. And he changed the world, but he didn't live to see it. You know, his darkness destroyed him, and he died as you said, at age 33.
Yeah.
An interesting guy.
Very. Yes. Do you think you'll write any more in this series?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't been asked.
Okay. Would you be interested?
It would depend on the subject. The thing about Alexander was that I was already interested in him and his time in history. So it was a natural for me to say yes. So it would be hypothetical. It would depend really on would I feel like I had time and was I interested in the subject?
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Writing young adult nonfiction, it was a whole new thing for me. I had only done fiction. And I enjoyed it a lot. You know, it's a different kind of challenge. And young adults want a really good story. Mm-hmm. They're very demanding readers. And so I think there is a similarity there. You want to tell a good story, whether it's biography or a novel. But how you tell that story, you're much more free in some ways as writing a novel, because it's basically whatever you can make work. Whereas, obviously, with biography or nonfiction, you have to stick to the facts.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, we've mentioned that this is a departure for you and that your other books are novels for young readers.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, just so that we can have a flavor of your other kind of writing, if you wouldn't mind reading something from your work.
I thought about this last night, and just on a whim, I pulled out the book called Raising the Shades, which was my first young adult novel after the Choose Your Own Adventure series. So in some ways, this is the first regulation novel that I'd written. The Choose series was a unique format and very different in the way that you told the story. This is a story about a boy named Casey who is 13. He's a seventh grader. And when you meet Casey, who is telling the story in Raising the Shades, his parents have recently broken up, and he's living with his dad in New Hampshire. And he is telling you that everything worked out great. But something isn't quite right, and as you read along, you feel this. Casey rushes home after school to clean up, and he won't hang out with his best friend anymore. He cleans up kind of in a frenzy before his dad gets home, so his dad won't get mad. And then his dad does come home, and he starts popping open one beer after another. And as a reader, I think you begin to put together what's wrong in this picture. But Casey doesn't want to see it. And then Casey goes in to do his homework, and his dad starts cooking dinner. But then there's this odd situation where he hears the garage door open and close. And he knows that means he has to get up and finish cooking the dinner. And so I want to read the chapter where this happens. This is the third chapter in the book. The sausages were sizzling and spitting in the pan. I turned them over. They were brown on the bottom, but not black. That was fine. I turned the sauce down. A pot of water was almost boiling. Everything was fine. The way things are, my dad needs me. We've always done a lot together. It's been better in a lot of ways since Mom and the Medalist moved to Maine. Things had pretty much frozen up solid in our house before the split. It seemed like we went through a long period of people getting colder and stiffer before things actually froze. That's how it was with my mom, especially. Until almost the end, I don't think my dad even noticed, which, of course, made it worse. The two of them got so they weren't speaking to each other at all, not in any unfrozen way. So when my mom finally left last spring, it was a relief. And it worked out the way it should have. My mom is used to taking care of everything and everybody, but lately she's been more and more into the Medalist and her shining career. The Medalist is my older sister, Shannon. She won the New Hampshire State Geography B in fifth grade, and she's never been second place in anything since. Girls softball star pitcher, seventh grade district science fair gold medalist. That's when I made up my personal name for her. Now she's a high school soccer starlet, as my mom never fails to tell me whenever we talk on the phone. So, anyway, this is fine. We paired up just like we should have. Shannon was supposed to spend a lot of time with my dad in the summer, and I was going to go be with my mom, but we wound up only doing that for one sad week in August. I wanted to be here, and Shannon wanted to be there, and our parents weren't sure about anything, so they let us have our way. I mean, I do miss my mom, but my dad needs me. And unless she's basking in the spotlight, the Medalist is basically helpless. She doesn't even pick up her own dirty clothes. How's she supposed to take care of him? I've learned to do, well, a lot. and my dad and I have the greatest plans. Next summer we're going to see the Red Sox play down in Boston at Fenway Park, which is such a great old ballpark, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. When I was little, we were there a couple of times. I still remember how the outfield grass looked when we came up the ramp and I saw it for the first time, softly glowing and perfectly green, like a magic carpet with ballplayers on it. We ended up not making it to Fenway this past summer, but we'll definitely go next season. My dad said so. We were going to go camping together, too, which is another thing we used to do in the summer, just the two of us. Actually, we did go camping, but my dad got upset the first night and he was sick the next morning, so we came back. But next summer, we'll go. Out in the garage, the loud music came on. Sometimes my mom used to go stomping out there. She'd fling open the door and the music would surge in, then she'd slam it behind her and we could hear her start yelling. No way was I going out there. The peppers were cut up on the counter. I tossed them in the pan with the sausages. This pan was still bluish and messed up on the bottom from being left on the stove too long with food burning in it. But it works fine. We've got one saucepan that still has a black crust of incinerated chili welded to the bottom. I couldn't even chip that off with a screwdriver. I remember those first few times when I'd be in my room and the house would start to smell funny. I'd say, "Dad? Hey, Dad?" Then I'd get up and open my door and the hall would be full of smoke. So, I learned. I didn't know how to cook anything back then, not to mention what to do with incinerated pans. Now I've cooked hamburgers, hot dogs, stir-fry, macaroni and cheese from the box, spaghetti, chili, and scrambled eggs. In the morning I make oatmeal, the real kind, not the instant. I do that really well. It settles our stomachs. As I'm cooking, the music stops. The door to the garage opens. My dad comes in. I don't look up. The refrigerator door opens. He glances over the rest of the first six-pack in his hand. "That'll be done soon," he says about the food. I nod. "It will be." And he goes into the living room. I take a deep breath. I hear the surge of voices as he switches on the TV and the springy wheeze when he hits the couch. I've got a feeling it'll be a nice, quiet night.
Wow.
And that's the chapter in Raising the Shades.
Thank you very much. That's really intense. I like how at the early part of that chapter he says everything was fine.
Yeah.
And then when he's talking about the pan, he says it works fine. And it sort of, it's a little refrain that lets us know nothing is fine.
Right.
You know? Everything's
right.
Got stuff burned in the bottom of it.
Right. That word fine, you know, it's the key word in the structure of denial. It's fine. Everything is fine.
Mm.
And I think as a reader, I'm interested in sort of, especially in a first-person book like that, drawing the reader in, you know, almost like a detective story with a little information and then a little more, so that you get it, the story's kind of coming together inside you rather than just right there on the page, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That word fine, you picked up right away. It doesn't mean fine. If the story works at this point, you get it on the level that you would in person. Something's wrong here, and this
mm-hmm.
kid's not admitting it, but it's true.
Now, how about as a writer, how soon did you know where you wanted to take this and where it was all going to resolve?
With this story, that story?
Yeah, that story, or if you see some pattern in your works as far as how these things come together?
It's an interesting question. I think there are two basic kinds of fiction writers, whatever age audience you're writing for, whether it's adults or children or young adults. I think there clearly are the people who plan it all out, and they know exactly what's going to happen in their book, in their story, before they start. I have a friend in Vermont who's a detective novelist, and she's got it all plotted out, which I think a detective novelist probably has to do, because the story depends on a really intricate machine of a plot. Then there are writers, and I'm one of these, where I wouldn't want to know how it's all going to work out, because then it wouldn't be any fun. It wouldn't be an adventure, you know? It would be kind of like setting out on a journey, but knowing exactly how it was going to work out. The journey wouldn't be that enticing, intriguing to you. And I think for me, if I didn't feel that intrigue, if I didn't want to have that process of discovering what's going to happen, then the reader wouldn't want to have it either.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, I want to have a strong start. I want to know who these characters are, basically. I try to spend time learning about the characters and doing whatever research I need to do. In this case, the story deals with alcoholism and drug dependency and its impacts on kids. If it's the parent with the problem, how does that impact the kid? So, you know, you do your research, but then for me, I just want to know how the story is going to start.
Yeah.
And even that may change, but I think of it as kind of, you know, It's like setting off on a journey where I don't know where I'm going to wind up, but I think it'll be interesting.
Yeah,
and sometimes it doesn't work out.
Do you often take wrong turns and kind of have to backtrack and rethink?
Yeah, that's the hazard of that approach, is that I think it's much more, for me, much more vital to have the writing of a story be kind of a process of discovery. From day to day, I find out what's going to happen and who are these characters. And from draft to draft to draft, you find out more. But you also have dead ends. Things don't work out. Sometimes whole books don't work out. And you just have to accept that as part of the journey, too.
Right.
Even when I throw something out of a draft, I think I've learned from it, because that may help me. Even though maybe I wrote a draft of a scene and it was ridiculously bad, but seeing why it was bad will probably help me see what would be better. Not knowing, I think, for me at least, the real challenge of creative work is being comfortable with not knowing.
Yeah.
In other words, I don't know how the story's going to work out. Therefore, I don't know if it's going to be any good when I decide to give 2 years of my life to writing it. The last novel I worked on, I wound up shelving after two and a half years. It didn't work out very well. And you have to take that chance. You know, but most of the time, if you keep at it, maybe it takes 3 drafts, maybe it takes 11, but most of the time you get to something you're proud of that you think works.
Yeah.
You know, but the whole key is you have to be honest. So if you're honest enough to say, after how many drafts did I work on my most recent book that I wound up scrapping, at least I've scrapped it for now. I don't know, it was a number of drafts, but at some point I got feedback from my agent and my editor and they didn't think it worked. And I decided to go and work on something new that I thought was promising.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I may go back to that other project. You know, you never know when a process ends. You can put a book aside, and then 3 years later, suddenly you realize, oh, you see what to do with it, and now you got to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to kind of keep an open mind.
Let's talk a little bit about The Revealers.
Okay.
Now, The Revealers is a book about bullying.
Yeah.
And you've been very successful at, or I guess the school system has been very happy about having this book to use in their programs.
A lot of the impetus for using the book, The Revealers, almost all of it has come from schools.
And it's not just the state of Vermont, it's over, right?
No, in fact, I'm working this year with a school in Bangladesh that has read the book. It's an international school, so it has students of different cultures. In the capital of Bangladesh, Dhaka, and they've read the book several times, and we're going to do a project where we set up an internet forum, you know, an interactive forum where we'll discuss the book, almost like I was a visiting author. But I've visited schools all over the country and heard from some other schools internationally, because bullying is a problem. It seems like all over the world. It doesn't seem to respect cultures. I've been in American schools of all different socioeconomic poor schools, rich schools, middle class schools. I've been in mostly white schools, mostly African American, mostly Latino schools, all kinds of mixes, urban, suburban, rural. I've been in one room schoolhouses in Vermont. I've been in inner city schools in Florida and Texas. I've been in suburban schools in the Silicon Valley in California and outside Chicago and wealthy towns outside Chicago and New York. And bullying is everywhere.
Right.
And I don't think it's just American culture, because I hear from people in Great Britain, I've heard from people in Australia and Indonesia and the Philippines, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, in a number of other countries that say, I struggled with bullying.
Right.
I think bullying has always been part of growing up, but...
Just the power play of kids.
Yeah, but for some reason, I don't think anybody fully understands, some combination of reasons, I hear over and over again from people who've worked in middle schools for decades that it's worse now than it's ever been. It's meaner, and it seems to be more unsparing, you know, this power struggle. There's a power struggle when you go through early adolescence, because everybody's trying to find their power, you know? Who am I going to be in the world? How am I going to be successful? How am I going to be somebody? And I think that's important. I think that kids have to find their power. We want them to, because we want you to be successful. If you have a son or a daughter, of course you want them to be successful. But the way that kids experiment with power at early adolescence often is by using it in negative ways against less powerful kids.
You know?
And that's what we call bullying.
It's interesting, because in The Revealers, three children who band together and become friends sort of stand up to bullies,
yeah.
and they actually use an internet, a school-controlled internet-like
right.
atmosphere to do this. But I'm wondering if the internet has made bullying worse in another way, you know, as far as you were saying things have gotten worse.
Oh, yeah.
And I do want to talk about the book, but I'm just curious, do you think that has something to do with it?
I think the internet is part of what has contributed to making bullying much more dangerous than it's ever been. I think that also our culture in a larger way is a factor here. Now, I don't think it's the only factor, but you turn on sitcoms on primetime television and there's incredible meanness between people. You know, people are just really nasty to each other. In some of the most popular shows, you listen to popular music, you know, and some of it, the lyrics and some songs kids are listening to are just appalling, just horrifying. And you watch some of the, you know, the videos that are posted on YouTube, and people are regularly humiliated, and then that becomes a big viral video because they got humiliated.
Mm-hmm.
So humiliation and meanness seem to be part of our culture. That's part of it. The other thing is the internet specifically, unlike television, gives young people incredible power because you can set up a blog. You can create a website to humiliate another person. You may be only 10 years old, but you have perfect skills to do that. And you may be much more skilled at that than your parents. You probably are. And so, you know, young people can use the internet to spread rumors, publish unfortunate videos and photographs, and otherwise, you know, humiliate and hurt people that they want to get for whatever reason, because they want to be the new popular kid, because they want to show that they'll do anything, you know, they want to be in a group, whatever reason. And this happens all the time.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
In middle schools, the schools are constantly coping with these rumors and character assassinations that just go like wildfire. Text messaging is another incredibly powerful tool. Kids can spread rumors like that, and overnight, something will get around that may be completely untrue, that, you know, feels like it's destroying a kid's life. And the next morning, the school staff has to pick up the pieces,
sure,
you know,
right.
And this happens all the time in middle schools. So that is a power that no generation's ever had before. When we were growing up, it was passing notes. Well,
yeah.
No, imagine compare a note, a folded up note, with spreading that rumor by text messaging and instant messaging and website that would be available to the whole world, you know,
right.
And you begin to see the difference in what kids are coping with today.
Right, right. And you think about how mortified you were just when a single small note was passed to three people. Some unkind untruth.
Right.
And then you think about that hitting 300 people.
And you've lost control. Imagine how you would feel if you realize it's zipping around the internet, whatever the rumor is. And that it's totally untrue, and it was vicious, and it was done for fun or to humiliate you, or because somebody wants you to be knocked off your perch in popularity, whatever it is. But now it's out of control. It's on the internet. It's spreading like wildfire. You don't know who's reading it. You don't know where they are, and you have no power to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine how that would feel to a kid who's already dealing with crippling self-consciousness the way we all did when we were 13 years old.
Right.
And that's the situation kids are in today.
So when you go into the schools to talk about the revealers, do you find that a lot of kids are coming to you and telling you their stories, not just of being bullied, but of having been bullies?
Oh, yeah. Well, kids, it's not safe for kids to stand up in the kind of crowd that I'll often talk. I may talk with 600 kids at once, or I may talk with 10 kids at once, and sometimes in the course of a school day I'll talk to both those size groups, and in neither situation is it safe for a kid who's being bullied to stand up and say, I'm being bullied. You know, it does happen sometimes, but often it's the kids who do not have, they're not aware of the ramifications of what they're going to say, because they're not able to be tuned in socially, and that may be why they're being picked on. But most kids are acutely aware of what would happen to them if they said in front of
made
everybody.
Public there.
Yeah. Even if they don't say a name. So often it's under the surface, but I will get handed notes. I will have kids come up to me afterwards. I'll have kids email me. I'm not saying that I get a flood of these things, but I've had some amazing communications from kids. It's not always about bullying, but often it is about uh-huh. what they're going through, you know,
right.
what they're struggling with.
Right. That must be sort of bittersweet. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure it's nice to feel like you're maybe being helpful.
You know, I try to, I certainly have no great power personally to help them. I'm not a psychologist or an educator, but I can pay attention to them. I respect who they are. And I think that's maybe what, in some ways, turns kids on about sharing something with me is that I'm writing for them, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm writing about their lives or what they go through, and I'm trying to listen to them. The stories that I write are realistic fiction for young adults, and they really do come out of, I'm a former newspaper guy, you know, I interview people, I listen to them, I try to pay attention. I'm not sure I'm all that good at it, but I'm always trying. And I think kids know that, and so there's something about that sometimes the kids that is really meaningful. Mm-hmm. This guy who writes books wants to know what I'm going through. Mm-hmm. And he listens to me, or he responds to my email. I think that alone is powerful in a way that just paying attention to that kid and respecting that kid.
Yeah.
You know, that's right. That's a power sometimes that I do have.
Now, something you said just triggered my memory. You were talking a minute ago about how you write realistic fiction for young readers.
Right.
Your blog mentions a newspaper article that you wrote titled, "Does Realistic Fiction Corrupt Young Adults?"
Right.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what brought you to write that article.
Well, I heard from a school principal who begged me not to tell anybody that she had called me. She was a school principal in rural North Florida, close to the Georgia border. Very, very much of a conservative area, very religious area, as you can imagine, the rural American South. And one of the teachers in the local middle school was reading The Revealers with the class. There's no religious content in The Revealers, but there is realistic depiction of how kids treat each other. There is some language, which is, again, realistic, how kids will talk to each other. There is some violence, because these things happen. And there was a family that was very, very vocal about objecting to this book, and had written letters to all the several local newspapers saying, you wake up to the kind of unchristian book that your children are being forced to read. And there was the teachers in the school were feeling very intimidated by this. There was a lot of local, you know, tension around it all of a sudden, and I heard from the principal, and I wrote a letter to the editor, which I sent to each of the papers that had printed the letter originally from these parents, saying, "Wake up, you know, your children are being forced to read this unchristian story." And I don't know, I could read a little bit of the letter.
Sure, that would be great.
It was published, and all I heard from afterwards was that it was helpful because the teachers felt like nobody was kind of standing up for them, and I think the controversy kind of settled down. But sadly, the teacher who had been teaching the book abandoned it in the middle of the book, was completely intimidated. So I had the chance to at least publish my side of the story, but the book was abandoned. So I'll just read a couple of paragraphs in this letter to the editor I wrote. I said, "In order for The Revealers to mean something to kids, almost all of whom will at some point have to cope with bullying in some form in their own lives, my story has to be honest. It has to feel real. Young adults are demanding readers. The second they think a novel is preaching at them or sugarcoating reality, most of them will put that book down. So a YA novel that's full of an author's ideas about how people should act instead of how they actually do simply won't do young readers much good. On the page in my book where the letter writers find offensive language, the character speaking is a bully whose word choices mimic what an abusive parent has been saying to him. Many real children live in similar situations. Can I tell them exactly how to solve that problem? Is growing up today really that simple? I don't think so. All through their lives, our kids will have to deal with other people's choices, including those that are hurtful or dishonest. They'll have to find their way through the internet age's flood of communication, entertainment, exploitation. We need to help them learn to guide their lives wisely. And I say here, I think that the parents who objected to my book, and I agree on this, there are many resources that can help. Religious books, of course, are one. I believe that honest, realistic fiction is another." I had started this letter by saying, I think these parents and I are on common ground in that we're concerned about the flood of manipulative and exploitive information that our kids are coping with. The real issue is, how do we respond?
Right.
You know? And they were saying we have to exclude this book that deals with an honest situation, and we have to make sure they only read certain types of books. And I was saying, I think a good realistic novel equips a young person to make safer, wiser decisions, you don't necessarily have to go through, for example, drug abuse. The book that I wrote after The Revealers deals with, in part, with the impacts of a young person's drug habit. I'm obviously not saying go out and do drugs, because that book deals pretty realistically with what happens in this boy's life.
And that is falling?
Yeah, and how it affects his family, his brother especially. If you read that book, you're going to have more information about what would happen if I get involved with drugs. How's it going to affect my life and my family? You may make a wiser decision when you're you know, presented with that, hey, dude, you want to get high? Which most young people are going to be presented with in their lives, that opportunity. But if I preach at you in my story, all drugs are bad and you should never, ever, then you're just going to shut my book because you don't want to be preached at. So whether I'm right or wrong doesn't really make a difference, mm-hmm. because I haven't had any impact. I haven't connected. I have to be honest in order to connect with you. I have to respect you as a reader. To right. me, that's what it's all about, is respecting the reader as an intelligent person who's going to make his or her own decisions. And, my job is to write a good story that's meaningful.
Right.
That's what I want to do. I don't want to preach. I don't think of myself as any authority or any big wise person. You know, I'm just trying to write a good story that means something.
The other thing that strikes me is the word realistic in the yeah. term realistic fiction, because these kids aren't going to be drawn into anything that's not realistic, that doesn't ring right. true to them. Like you said, honest, as they look into a book, whether or not it's preachy, you don't want it to be preachy, but even if it comes across as overly simplistic or not ringing true, yep. they're not going to want to read it.
In visiting
they're
schools,
not going to believe it.
It's true. I agree exactly with what you say. In visiting schools, I often do a fun little experiment. And it always works out the same way. I will say, let's say I have 50 kids in the room. I'll say, how many of you have ever, raise your hand if you've ever started to read a story, a book like mine, but you pretty quickly figure out that the author of the story is trying to teach you a lesson, And usually I would say on average about 1 in 4, 1 in 5 hands in that room will go up. And then I'll say, okay, second question, how many of you finished reading that book? And it's rare that more than 1 in 10 hands goes up that second time. It's always a small fraction of the first group that says,
yeah.
I finished reading that book. I said, that's what I'm talking about. That's
right.
it right there. If you stop reading the book, it doesn't matter how good it is or how true it may be. It has had no impact.
Mm-hmm.
It's been wasted effort. So if I think I've got the right message for you and I give it to you in a preachy story, it'll be wasted effort. Anyway, that's... I try not to do that. And I really don't think I have any answers anyway,
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be pretty presumptuous to think that I could tell an intelligent 13-year-old how to live her life, She may be very religious. She may not be religious. She may be struggling with depression. She may be on top of the world. He may be somebody who knows just what he wants to do with his life, or he may not. A lot of kids have secret problems like parental addiction or abusive environments at home that we have no clue that is going on for them. So I can't tell them how to solve that incredibly tough problem in their
right.
lives.
Yeah.
I don't have those answers.
Right. I wonder if you can mention some of your favorite books, either children's
yeah.
books or books for adults.
Writers tend to write the books they like to read. So if you like sci-fi, you're going to be a sci-fi writer. I never was much of a fantasy or sci-fi or horror type reader. I always liked, growing up, I read realistic fiction and historical nonfiction, those kind of books. So I like realistic novels for young adults that seem to mean something, that have something, when I'm done reading it, I feel like I'm more of a person than I was when I started. I may not be able to tell you how. It's not like I've learned some lesson. I think that's very two-dimensional. I'm more three-dimensional as a person when I'm done. And those are really special books. That's what I want to try to write. And I love, these are just a few of the books that for young adults that I thought of that I really liked. I like a writer named Joan Bauer.
Uh-huh.
And Joan Bauer is a modern contemporary writer who usually has female heroines, and they can be in the most unglamorous situations. She wrote one about a girl who likes to grow giant vegetables. Now, what internet plugged in, kid is going to want to read about growing pumpkins? But she did a great story. It was called Squashed. And my favorite of hers is called Hope Was Here, which is about a young woman who's a diner waitress. A book that I really like is called Tangerine by Edward Bloor, set in the tangerine groves in Florida. It involves, in part, an environmental theme. It also involves the privilege that young athletes are often given and the way a community will turn a blind eye to questionable behavior by the cool jocks. Interesting book. A book that doesn't get remembered much but I loved is called The Goats by Brock Cole. And The Goats deals with bullying. It's about a summer camp. It's actually two camps, a boys' and a girls' camp on opposite sides of a lake with an island in between. And once a year, those two camps come together for a picnic day, boys and girls. But the secret tradition in the camp is that the cool kids always select a goat, the most geeky, awkward, unpopular kid in the camp. And they leave that child on the island. They lock the child into the bathroom without any clothes. Mm-hmm. Every year they do this, and they leave both a boy and a girl naked on the island. And these are the goats. But this year, the two goats decide not to take this, and they escape the island. And that's a wonderful story. Briefly, a couple others that I really like. A book by a Vermont writer named Amy Ehrlich, E-H-R-L-I-C-H, is called Joyride. But a lot of people, like me, read it when it had a previous title, which was Where It Stops, Nobody Knows. And this is a book about a girl, teenage girl, who's traveling the country with her mom. But every couple months, suddenly they have to move in the middle of the night. And the girl doesn't know why, but she loyally goes along. And Amy, who I met once, lives in the Northeast Kingdom, if I remember right. She didn't like the title the publisher put on the book, which was Where It Stops, Nobody Knows. So it's been retitled Joyride. And that is, I'm not sure that has helped people find this wonderful book. And another one that's more recent is called Drums, Girls, and Dangerous Pie. And this is a story from the viewpoint of a young teenager who has got talent in drumming. And he's trying to be cool with this, but suddenly there's a very serious situation in his family, very, very scary situation, and he has to deal with it. And that's got a lot of humor, although it doesn't sound like it. That's a guy named Jordan Sonnenblick. And it's called Drums, Girls, and Dangerous Pie.
Okay.
I like humorous novels, and they're very hard to find on any level. The guy who's famous for writing Holes, which I think is a great, great book, Louis Sacker, also wrote a couple of previous comic novels that I really love. One of them is called Dogs Don't Tell Jokes. Another one's called Someday Angeline. And Louis Sacker is S-A-C-H-A-R. Holes is not so much funny as sort of absurd and amazing. I love Holes. But these books are really good comic novels. A couple of classic young adult page turners that I still reread are Kidnapped by Robert Louis Stevenson, which is an incredible adventure story. He also wrote Treasure Island, but I like Kidnapped. It's set in Scotland in the 1700s, if I remember right, and it's just a great adventure, swashbuckling, sword fights and kidnapping, and oh my gosh. And a book called Kim by Rudyard Kipling is set in India under British rule in about 1900. And it's a great, great story of a young man who's half British and half Indian. He's grown up in the slums, and he becomes recruited by the British spy service. But he also attaches himself to a wandering holy man. So it's this incredible story that's kind of a great early spy novel. It's a coming-of-age story, and it's kind of a spiritual search story. I love that book, Kim. Couple of young adult novels that are set in different times and places that I really like are Jerry Spinelli's Milkweed, which is set in the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II, from the point of view of a street urchin who has no education, and at first he thinks the Nazis are really cool because they've got cool boots and cool guns. And a book called The Thief Lord by Cornelia Funke, set in Venice, a wonderful story. So those are some really good YA novels that I really like.
Okay, thank you very much.
So thank you for getting me to make a list.
You made the list. Now you have the list. It's a great list. Yeah. I have to check out some of those. I don't know all of them. So my last question for you is, what advice do you have for writers who maybe sometimes get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Yeah, I love this question because everybody gets stuck at some point. Nobody knows how to write. The first thing to understand is that there's no right way to do it. Writing is, it's a process of discovery. It's always an adventure, and you're going to fall off a cliff, and you're going to get stuck in a blind alley, and you're going to get lost in the darkness sometimes. The key thing is to understand, I think, that it's a process, and that you rarely really totally understand where this process is going or how it's working. You just learn to work with it and defeat it. So let's say you're writing a story or a novel and you get to a point where you just have no clue what's going to happen next, or for some reason you can't write another word, but you can find a way to keep that process going. It may be that you need to do some research, and that's why you got stuck, because you don't know enough. Sometimes I realize I've got to go learn something about, I don't know, the internet, or writing for young people, you're always having to learn about how they communicate today, you know, texting, websites, YouTube, Facebook, you know. That may be what I have to learn about, or maybe it's something totally different. Police procedures. Once I had to stop and call a cop when I was working on Falling, it involved a detective, and ask about how would the police follow up on a certain situation. I didn't know. I couldn't write that until I learned. Here's what I want to say specifically about if you get stuck. I find free writing to be a really useful tool. I may not know what's going to happen in my chapter next, but I may know what my questions are. You know, I don't get what this person would be feeling. I'm not sure I understand what's going to happen when these two people are in the room together. I'm not sure I understand what this person is thinking right now. Whatever my questions are, I can free write, which means I'll take my computer or my notebook and I'll either say I'm going to write for a certain period of time. Maybe it's 10 minutes. That's not much time, but you can write a lot in 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'll say I'm going to fill 3 pages of my notebook. That's the only guideline you give yourself in free writing. You don't try to be intelligent. You don't try to compose anything. You don't try to write well. You don't want to try to write well. You want to be totally just free. But you say, I'm going to start writing and I'm not going to stop for 3 pages or 10 minutes. That's the idea. That's a free write. And I often, when I'm stuck on a page or a chapter, will free write about my questions. I'll write my questions out and then I'll just try to keep going. Well, I don't know. Maybe I could do this. Well, maybe I could do that. Sometimes, fairly often, I'll find by the end of 3 pages or 10 minutes, the answer to my perplexity has swum up and I get it. Sometimes it doesn't happen right then, but what I've done is I've moved the process along.
And I think that it's really interesting that you specifically set yourself certain questions before you free write, and you figure out what it is specifically that you don't know. That's helpful, because I think sometimes people look at free writing as the whole universe of all words, and to narrow it down to certain questions, that's...
I think it's a way to get into it, and you never know where a free write will take you, but I think what you said is really wise. If you try to write about the universe, you're going to be more blocked, you know. But if you try to do something specific, you know, write specifically about maybe it's my questions because I'm stuck with my chapter.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's my character. Sometimes I'll free write about a character. You know, who is she? What is she? What's her home life like? What are her problems? What are her concerns? You know, what is she worried about? It's often in the writing that I discover stuff. I don't know that it's there, but if I write, it seems to come up, and I'll say, wow, okay, I didn't know that was there, but then, you know, now I get it.
Great. Well, thank you very much for talking with me. This is great.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you very much, Shayla.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Doug Wilhelm. You can learn more about his work at his websites, DougWilhelm.com and The-Revealers.com. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write a story or poem in which someone runs out of gas. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing the outcome of a writing prompt from the show, please email me at writethebook@gmail.com. If you'd like to share the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, news about book-related events, or a writing prompt to share, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to the podcast version of the show, which airs every Monday on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.